Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Well, you can go ahead and be seated. I am so absolutely thrilled that you're here because the church is the most important thing in the world. We're paying a lot of attention nationally to all the political things, and politics are important, and a lot of attention on the economy, and the economy is important, and military and nations and things like that. But Jesus' eyes are on the church, and His heart is in the church. He said, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." And so, as important as all these other things are, your being here today communicates something very vital, something very important, and that is that you are a part of what we're going to be calling today God's Dream Team. And God's been building His Dream Team for a long, long time, and you're a part of it. And I'm so thankful that you're here. So thank you, all of you. And whether you're a senior pastor, whether your senior pastor invited you, asked you to come, made you come, whatever the case might be, we are glad that each and every one of you are here. When we use this term dream team, and let me just say this to begin with, we're going to be using a lot of sports analogies, a lot of sports illustrations today. I know not everybody is a huge sports fan, and in the time that we've been doing this, the feedback that we've gotten is the people who are sports fans, especially people who've been sports fans for a long time, really, really like this seminar because it's kind of a stroll down memory lane and that type of thing. But even the people who aren't big sports fans have come away saying, "But you know what? We liked it anyway." But for those of you that are sports fans, the term dream team has a very specific connotation. And if we can go to that next slide, you're seeing the 1992 U.S. Olympic basketball team. The 92 Olympics were the very first time that our NBA professional athletes were allowed to compete in the Olympics. And many sports analysts and historians say that this was the most dominating team, the most impressive team that was ever assembled for any sport in history. Up in the upper right-hand corner, you see three of those guys. You know, Jesus had Peter, James, and John. They had Michael, Magic, and Larry. And these guys, in the 92 Olympics, they beat the teams that they played by an average of 44 points a game. Nobody came, even remotely close to beating them. And the one common denominator, in addition to the absolute pounding that they gave everybody, was the fact that every team they played asked to have their picture taken with them before the game, because it was just such an amazing collection. And it wasn't just Magic, Michael, and Larry, although they kind of got a lot of the publicity, but they had Karl Malone, Charles Barkley, David Robinson, Patrick Ewing, Scottie Pippen, Chris Mullin, Clyde Drexler, John Stockton, Christian Laettner. If you're a basketball fan, you know, they're just the cream of the crop. That's all there is to it. And one of the most fun moments of the entire Olympics that year was there was a guy from one of the teams, one of the other countries, that was guarding Magic Johnson. And during the game, the guy who was guarding Magic was seen kind of half guarding Michael and half waving frantically at a guy on the bench of his team, one of his teammates, that he had given his camera to because he wanted to make sure that they got a picture of him guarding Magic Johnson. So he was waving in that time. But that's just kind of what that was. And, that dream team has taken its place literally in the annals of sports history. But God is building a dream team and has been since Jesus first began to call those original group to Himself. God is building a dream team in the earth that is making a mark in eternity. And I'm glad that you're a part of God's dream team. On your handout, everybody should have a handout, and we just do that to help you follow along with some of the thoughts. But one of the first statements on there is this simple statement, that the most noticeable thing about the 92 dream team was that they were all superstars. But the most noticeable thing about the dream team that Jesus assembled was that they were all completely ordinary. They were common people with regular lives. They really had not distinguished themselves as great scholars or philosophers or orators or achievers in life. They were just common, ordinary people. And that is what God is still doing today, is getting ordinary people. How many of you are just pretty ordinary? You know, we're just common folk. God is still taking common, ordinary people and making us into disciples, followers of His, but then also building us into a dream team. You know, when you look at the group that Jesus put together, they weren't always just the sharpest people in the world. Jesus one time talked about them kind of being slow learners. How many of you ever would acknowledge that you've been slow to learn some things? That, you know, God had to kind of work with you a little bit over. He talked about them being dull of heart and that they lacked understanding, that they had hard hearts, that they lacked faith, had unbelief. Sometimes He talked about them being fearful and all that type of thing. So, I mean, that was the group that Jesus started with. He just didn't start with the ultra superstars. And we have a statement here in your handout that says they ultimately became a great team through their association with Jesus and by the influence of the Holy Spirit, but they had to overcome problems common to all. Stop and think about that original band of disciples. How different are they from us today? Not very. They had to overcome things like inferiority, pride, jealousy. Here's something they had to overcome: foot and mouth disease. Which disciple had to overcome that the most? Peter, always sticking his foot in his mouth, always engaging the mouth before the brain really got operating too much. You know, they had to deal with doubts and fear, failures, and they even, here's a statement I like to recognize, they even slept through some of their most crucial times of training. You know, we mentioned a minute ago about Larry Bird and Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson. They were kind of the three, you know. The whole team was great, but then there were those three that, you know, just kind of had that special role. And when you stop and think about how Jesus ministered to everybody. He ministered to the multitudes, but then He had the 70, didn't He? And then He had the 12, and then He had the three. And when you look at the best Jesus had, Peter, James, and John. And you see that there were three specific times in Jesus' ministry when He was going to take His Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, and Larry Bird. And He was going to take them apart for some special intensive time of training where He could pour some things into them that, you know, the rest weren't even going to get. And those three special times of training were, one was on the Mount of Transfiguration, where He brought those three with Him. One was in the Garden of Gethsemane, and the third was when He raised the daughter of Jairus from the dead. If you stop and think about the biblical record, they slept, Peter, James, and John slept through the Garden of Gethsemane and the Mount of Transfiguration. They slept through two out of the three greatest events in human history. And the only time they stayed awake was when there was a dead body in the room. And they were probably just too nervous to sleep. Otherwise, they would have probably been sleeping then also. How many of you know that Jesus is able to take us with even our flaws and our faults and our shortcomings, and He loves us anyway? And He still builds us and develops us, and He wants to use us as His dream team. There's an imaginary story about the day that Jesus returned to heaven. The angels gathered around and asked Jesus to explain what had happened down here on earth. And they said, "Did they make you king?" And Jesus answered, "No." "Did they make you prince?" And Jesus answered, "No." "Did they worship you?" And Jesus said, "Most of them did not." "Well, what happened then?" And Jesus said, "They crucified me." "But after you rose from the dead, then everybody worshiped you, right?" And Jesus said, "No." And the angel said, "So what is your plan now?" And Jesus said, "I left my people down there." And the angels looked very skeptical and they said, "But if they fail, what is your other plan? And Jesus said, I have no other plan. That's kind of sobering, isn't it? On your handout, we have a statement here that says, we are plan A. There is no plan B. And one of the main lessons that we learn from the lives of the original 12 disciples is that if God can use them, then God can use us. God's always been building dream teams. When He raised up Moses. And see, this is why this seminar to me is so important, is because whenever God wants to do something in the earth, He always does, there's a certain pattern He always follows. He always raises up a leader, but then He always raises up a team to support and help that leader. And together, they're able to do things that none of them could have ever done individually. Moses was raised up by God for a great cause and purpose, but it wasn't long before God began to build a team around him. David, if you look at David's original team, you have a statement here in your handout, his team began with an unlikely group. 1 Samuel 22:2 says, and everyone who is in distress, and everyone who is in debt, and everyone who is discontented gathered to him, so he became captain over them. And yet it was from that ragtag group of disgruntled, disenfranchised, disoriented, you know, people with all kinds of problems that God raised up David's mighty men. Jesus, you know, when you look at the 12 disciples, they're a bunch. They're a case. It's not all about, you know, the celebrities of the dream teams that you and I know about in modern sports. There's a statement here that says the world looks for those who are celebrities, but God looks for those who are willing to be servants. Let's carry this just a little bit further. This is not in your handout, but it'll be on the screen. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, from the Message version, what Paul said to one church. He said, take a good look, friends, at who you were when you got called into this life. I don't see many of the brightest and best among you. Not many influential, not many from high society families. Isn't it obvious that God deliberately chose men and women that the culture overlooks and exploits and abuses, chose those nobodies to expose the hollow pretensions of the somebodies? That makes it quite clear that none of you can get by with blowing your own horn before God. Everything that we have, right thinking and right living, a clean slate and a fresh start, comes from God by way of Jesus Christ. And that's why we have the saying, if you're going to blow a horn, blow a trumpet for God. So it's a good thing that we're here today. It's a good thing that you are where you are in your church, in relationship with your pastor, supporting the vision, being a part of the team, contributing from your gifts and your talents and your abilities. As I said, we're going to be using a lot of sports illustrations, sports analogies today. But the idea to do that did not originate with me. We're going to get into a lot of sports things and all that, and if you're not a big sports fan, you might think, well, you know, why is he using all that to illustrate spiritual truth? Well, because the Apostle Paul started it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we see that the Apostle Paul used the sports analogy method from his day to communicate truth. And he, one of the popular sports back then, if you remember the Olympic Games, which started in Greece where Corinth is located. And Corinth had their own games that were very close by. They were called the Isthmian Games, and they were just very similar to the Olympic Games. And everybody in Corinth would have been familiar with how these athletic events took place. And Paul used some illustrations from some of the running events to communicate this. Look at what Paul says, 1 Corinthians 9:24. He says, don't you realize that in a race everyone runs, but only one person gets the prize? So run to win. And that word win in the Greek, it's a pretty aggressive word. It means to take eagerly, to seize, and to possess. I believe there's something about being a Christian that just automatically does away with the permission to be a passive Christian. to not be a casual, comfortable Christian. There's something about the charge of being a believer and being a follower of Jesus that just puts something aggressive in our hearts. I don't mean aggressive in a negative, hostile way, but aggressive in a proactive, diligent, determined way to serve God with every fiber of our being. Paul said, run to win. And that word, again, means to take eagerly, to seize, or to possess. And Paul says all athletes are disciplined in their training. They do it to win a prize that will fade away. You know, when you stop and think about what people in this world are applying themselves to, athletes, businessmen, entrepreneurs, they're all doing it for something that's going to fade away. You know, they may win a championship, they may get a raise, they may get a bonus, but all of that is temporal. It's all going to pass away. The things that people put their energy and their efforts into in this world, and I know we have to put our energy and effort into some natural things. I'm not discounting that. But our service for the kingdom of God is something that produces an eternal reward. And it should motivate us higher than a paycheck. It should motivate us higher than a trophy of some kind or some kind of championship. Paul said they do it to win a prize that will fade away, but we do it for an eternal prize. You know, I don't think that many Christians really, really ever stop to think about what eternity is going to be like. Because we have, and rightly so, we have preached grace. And you know what grace means is that the way that you and I get into heaven has nothing to do with our perfection. Really has nothing to do with our performance. How many of you know you can't be good enough to get into heaven? You know, you're not going to get into heaven because of an attendance award. You know, because, you know, you were really good to attend Sunday school or whatever. Now, we should attend church and we should serve God, but that's not why you're getting into heaven. I mean, one of the things we all understand this, by grace are you saved through faith. And that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. Listen, we can't earn our way into heaven, deserve our way into heaven. The only reason that you and I are going to heaven is because Jesus Christ died on a cross, shed His blood so that we could be forgiven, and He rose from the dead. All of the works that get us into heaven are His works, not ours. But that's just getting in. What about once we get to heaven? Then we start talking about a whole different thing. Then we start talking about rewards. And you don't get to heaven based on works. But can I tell you something? The whole reward thing is set up based on what we did, based on our works, based on our labors. We are going to be judged based on our works in terms of the rewards that we receive in heaven. And I don't know about you, but when I get to heaven, I want to hear two words, well done. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. I don't want to hear three words, well, you're done. The Bible says that God is a rewarder. And Paul said, we do it for an eternal prize. Do you really have a concept that by working hard for God, and I know even in working hard for God, being faithful, being diligent, serving, we still don't take the credit like, look what I did. We do it by His grace and by His anointing and by the gifts that He gave us. There's always an element of grace involved. You know, that verse we talked about earlier, by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. That makes it clear that we are not saved by works. But the very next verse says, for we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus, unto good works. Say this out loud with me. I am not saved by works, but I am saved unto works. See, as believers, we are called to be workers. And our works, the effort that we put forth to love one another, encourage one another, support one another, serve within the local church and help and so on. Paul says we are doing it for an eternal prize. That should motivate us to work. And then he goes on to say, look at verse 26. So I run with purpose in every step. I'm not just shadow boxing. See, we're not just going through the motions. We're not just going to church because it's Sunday and we're supposed to go to church because it's Sunday. And we're not just going through the motions. We need to have purpose in every step. We need to be people of purpose who are serving God intentionally and consistently. We have dedicated and consecrated our entire life. Sure, we're going to take care of the natural things of life. We're going to, you know, take care of our families, and we're going to do the laundry and mow the yard, and we're going to do the things that we need to do to, you know, function in life. But really, our heartbeat, our passion, our purpose is to make a difference for eternity. Amen. It's to see as many people as possible avoid hell and go to heaven. It's to see as many people as possible grow in the knowledge of God. And whether it means that we're going to clean the toilets in the church or sweep the carpet or run the audiovisual things or work with the children or work in prison outreach or nursing homes or teaching or ushering or whatever it is that we do, we're running with purpose in every step. We're not just going through the motions. He said, I discipline my body like an athlete, training it to do what it should. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You can't be a flesh-ruled Christian and really carry out purpose.
That's right.
How many of you know your body doesn't always want to volunteer and serve and get up early and maybe be there for more than one service or... You know, your body would like to just kind of take it easy and coast. Paul said, I discipline my body. If you're going to win in God, if you're going to win in Christian service, you're going to have to discipline your body. Your body doesn't always even want to lift its hands to worship God. You know, there's just a lot of things. We make our body do certain things because it's our slave, not our master. I discipline my body, training it to do what it should. Otherwise, I fear that after preaching to others, I myself might be disqualified. Now, look at another verse here, 2 Timothy 2:5. Paul, again, uses an athletic illustration. He says, if anyone competes as an athlete, he does not receive the victor's crown unless he competes according to the rules. There are some principles of effective Christian service. And one of the things that I want to do today, because the Apostle Paul introduced the whole concept of using natural athletics, natural sports, to illustrate spiritual truth, I decided that I wanted to do a study of coaches and athletes in modern history and even contemporary events. And I wanted to see what great coaches and great athletes had to say. One of the things that Paul said for the believer was run to win. And you know, we have a lot of emphasis on success in our society today. And one of the things that I did, a few different books I read and got information about what a lot of coaches have said about success. And I want to give you some of these quotes from some of these different guys. Here's one, Brian Billick, who led the Baltimore Ravens to a 2000 Super Bowl championship. He said, success is maximizing the talent that you have. One of the things that I saw in looking at coach after coach after coach was they kept emphasizing this, that success and winning is not just about the final outcome of a certain game. It's about way more than that. Billick said it's maximizing the talent that you have. Tony Dungy, Indianapolis Colts, 2007 Super Bowl coach, said, I would define success as doing the absolute best you are capable of doing. He said, that's not the same as winning every game. It's being as good as you could possibly be. Ken Hitchcock, who coached the Dallas Stars to the Stanley Cup championship back in the late 90s, said, for me, success as a coach is getting your team to act and behave as one. That, to me, is a compliment. When somebody says, boy, your team plays like a team. Bill Walsh, who led the 49ers to 3 Super Bowl championships, said, success is progress. It's becoming better at what you do. That's what I always emphasize with the players, that if you can improve your skills and take advantage of it, that's success. I don't necessarily measure it in winning and losing, although that's always a factor. But if you've improved, that's success. And John Wooden won 10 national championships in basketball with the UCLA Bruins in 12 years. unparalleled success as a coach. He said, success to me is peace of mind, which is the direct result of self-satisfaction in knowing you made the effort to become the best of which you were capable. Success is coming as close as possible to reaching your maximum potential at whatever task you're involved in. I love those definitions. Paul said, run to win. And I think one of the things that we have to do as a church and as believers is we have to ask the question, what does it mean for a church to win? What does it mean for a church to win? Does it mean that we have more people than the other church across town? Does it mean we have a nicer building? Does it mean that we have a bigger budget? Does it mean that we're in competition with each other? See, the one thing that I think is a little bit different in Christianity and in the church, in natural sports, you're trying to beat the other team. I believe in the Christian walk, we're not competing against anybody else. We are competing against our own potential. If this thing is about an attendance award, and don't misunderstand me, because every church here wants to reach as many people for Jesus as they can. But if this is about attendance, then Dr. Cho has that award already won. He's got 800,000 members, or that's the last figure I heard. He makes Joel Osteen's church look like a very, very small, insignificant church. This is not about attendance. Although we do want to reach as many people as we can for Jesus. This is really about becoming the best that we can be as individuals and as church. This is about, have we fulfilled our potential? Have we maximized our gifts? Have we maximized our talents? There's another coach, basketball coach at Memphis University, John Calipari, that said this. He said, the dream comes true when you reach your potential. And I might want to emphasize that just a little bit differently. The dream comes true when you reach your potential. Let me share with you a few thoughts that I believe are really important about winning and success in the local church. Number one, I believe that it's important for every individual and every department to define what a win looks like for them. Every individual and every department to define what a win looks like for them. Did you know that a win for the greeters is a little bit different than a win for the prison outreach team? We all have different potentials. We all have different things that we're endeavoring to accomplish. And in the church, the ultimate win for a church is when everybody is functioning at a certain high level, high capacity of different ones, individuals and departments, each reaching their potential. Let's take this back to professional sports. In professional sports, for example, the front office wins when they recruit the right players. The coach wins when he inspires and instructs the players well. The trainers win when they keep the players in optimum health. The players win when they prepare well and then execute their skills on the field of competition to the best of their ability. But what if you have everybody who's doing it all right? And let's just say a few years ago when Michael Jordan played for the Bulls, the front office has loaded the team with the best players they could. The coach has trained and taught the players well. The trainers have kept everybody in good health. The players are playing their very best. But the equipment manager forgets to bring Michael Jordan's tennis shoes to the game. It takes everybody doing well to create success, but any one person not doing their job at a given time can cause lots of problems for the whole team. Some of you may remember a third baseman for the Baltimore Orioles years ago named Brooks Robinson. And by the way, if you have this card, baseball card that we're going to show, I'd like to talk to you after the deal. He said to make a ball club a champion, the effort has to start with the bat boy and move right up to the owner. He was recognizing the significance of every single person's contribution. Here's a second thing that's important when it comes to the church and winning. Number two, we need to define wins as steps, not so much as outcomes. We like the good outcome, but we need to define wins as steps. For example, in church, we tend to think of the Sunday morning service as the outcome. But did you know that before there's ever a Sunday morning service, did you know there's a whole lot of steps that are taking place all week long? People planning, people praying, people studying, people organizing, people coordinating. And it's not just the outcome that counts, it's all the steps that take place in the process. And success in church is very much like an iceberg. You've all seen the cutaway pictures of an iceberg, how that, you know, there's just a little tiny tip above the surface of the water, but there's this huge bulk of ice that's beneath the surface. There's far more that goes on in churches behind the scenes than there are that the general public ever sees. And Mike Krzyzewski, the great coach at Duke, made this statement. He said, our goal is not to win. It is to play together and play hard. Then winning takes care of itself. But we have to define wins as steps, not just the outcomes only. It's not just what people see on the surface. Here's a third statement about wins in church. We need to celebrate wins all along the journey. You know, we don't just wait to heaven until we rejoice and celebrate, you know, having been able to serve God. You know, we can be a culture of encouragement where we're celebrating wins, we're encouraging each other, we're patting each other on the back, we're giving each other high fives, so to speak. We're verbally affirming each other. You know, that is why this idea of celebrating wins all along the journey and enjoying the process is why the angels celebrate every single time a person gives their life to God. Yeah, yeah. Every single time that a person gives their heart and their life to Jesus and is born again, the angels are celebrating. Yeah. Because they understand the importance of celebrating the wins all along the journey. There's a verse, and it's not in your handout, I don't believe, but it's going to be on the screen, Isaiah chapter 41. It's a verse that I came across some time ago, and it says, everyone helped his neighbor and said to his brother, be of good courage. So the craftsman encouraged the goldsmith. He who smooths with the hammer inspired him who strikes the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering. Then he fastened it with pegs that it might not totter. I read that verse in the book of Isaiah, and I really was impressed by that because when I read that, I saw that here's a group of guys, it appears at least four or five different guys that are all working on this project. They're building something. And you almost see, you know, one guy does his part, and then the next guy comes and does his part, but they're cheering each other on. They're inspiring each other. They're encouraging each other. Man, you did a good job, you know, sculpting that. You did a great job in the gold work. You did a great job fastening the legs. And they're all, it's like there's this project that they all are putting their talent into, and they realize that the project is bigger than any of them individually. There's no ego involved. They're just doing it for the sake of quality work, and they're glad to be doing it as part of a team. And I thought, that is really great. I said, I've got to use that in our Dream Team seminar. And I thought, because of being a Bible teacher, I thought, well, but I want to know the historical background of this. So I decided to study this out in some Hebrew commentaries. And after I did, I wished I hadn't. Because I found out all the commentators, all the scholars say that this is a description of people who are making false gods. This is a description of people who are sculpting man-made idols that would be then worshipped by people in ignorance and darkness. And I thought for a minute, I was really bummed out. I thought, well, that I can't use that in the seminar now. And I thought, wait a minute. Yes, I can. Because if those people can be that excited and that unified about building a false god, how much more should God's people be able to encourage and inspire and work in teamwork? See, those guys weren't competitive against each other. They weren't jealous about each other. They were all because they believed that what they were making was more important than any of them individually. How much more should we as God's people be able to celebrate, you know, at every stage of the journey, be able to celebrate what's being accomplished? Here's a fourth point on winning in the church, and that's number four. We need to redefine wins as we move further in our journey. Don't rest on past wins. Albert Hubbard said, if what you did yesterday still looks big to you, you haven't done much today. I believe the church and the church's greatest days and the church's greatest accomplishments are ahead. I want to look at a verse in Hebrews chapter 12, and especially from the New Living Translation. Hebrews, the 12th chapter, says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that so easily trips us up, and let us run with endurance the race that God has set before us. We do this by keeping our eyes on, and I like this in the New Living Translation, we do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion, who initiates and perfects our faith. How many of you know that Jesus truly is a champion? Want to just look up, I like definitions and just make sure I am seeing it from all the different vantage points. And I looked up the word champion in a dictionary and I found out, and these are going to be common to you. A champion is a hero or a brave warrior. Hence, one who is bold in contest, figuratively as a champion for the truth. A champion is one who shows marked superiority. They really excel in what they do. They're not just going through the motions. They're not just doing enough to get by. They're not meeting minimum standards. They're showing marked superiority. In other words, they're determined to be the very best they can be. And then a third definition is that a hero is a winner of first place in a competition. And all those are good definitions. I like them. But then I came across a couple of definitions that are what the dictionary will use the term archaic, meaning it's an old definition. It's a definition that we may not use much today, but it's how it used to be understood. And sometimes, how many of you know the English language changes? Yeah. And I love the poetic beauty and even the inspiration of the King James Bible. But one of the reasons why I enjoy the modern translations also is because some of the times the words don't even mean the same that they meant 300 years ago. And so the word champion hundreds of years ago meant the following: one who undertakes combat in the place or cause of another, or one that does battle for another's rights or honor. See, when you and I think today of a champion, you know, Tiger Woods, for example, he's a phenomenal golfer. I don't think anybody would dispute using the term champion. And I'm sure he's a very wonderful individual, seems to have great character. And I know he's got some philanthropic endeavors where some of his millions upon millions of dollars goes to help other people. But when you think of Tiger Woods as a champion, he's predominantly playing golf for himself. When you think of Roger Federer, the Wimbledon champion for the last 4 or 5 years in tennis, being in Switzerland last year, they told us what a great gentleman he was and what a nice guy he is and how that the whole country is so proud of him because he's such a gentleman and all that type of thing. And I'm sure he's a very nice individual, like they say. But when we say that he's a tennis champion, he's predominantly winning championships for himself. Nothing wrong with that. But the old definition of a champion was somebody who fought not for themselves, but they fought for someone else. And the only time that the word champion is used in the regular New King James or King James version of the Bible is in 1 Samuel, and it's in reference not to a good guy, but a bad guy. It's in reference to Goliath. He was the champion of the Philistines. And see, they came to understand some things back then. And you remember the encounter between David and Goliath? Do you remember what Goliath would come out and say? He would come out and he would march out and he would say, "I am here to fight as a representative for the entire Philistine army. You pick someone who will be your representative, and if he and I fight, if I kill him, then you will be our servants. If he kills me, then we will be your servants." See, they had figured out, it just got really messy. If you have 5,000 soldiers on each side and they all go fight each other, there's going to be thousands of people killed. And they figured out kind of a better way to do it is just let each side pick their best one and let those two guys fight. And then whoever wins, well, then that their whole side wins. That was what, and we have a statement in your handout, this is what was called champion warfare. One man would fight as a representative on behalf of an entire army. If he won, his army benefited. If he lost, his army suffered. And here's our final statement here. You need to see yourself as a champion servant. When you win, and what is our definition of winning? What is our definition of success again? It means that you achieve your potential. It means that you maximize your talents. It means that you become the very best that you can be. You become the most effective servant of God that you can possibly be given your giftings, your personality, your skills, your temperament. You become the very best you can be. You need to see yourself as a champion servant. When you win, when you do your job well, others benefit. If you fail to do your job well, then others suffer. Let me just give you this example in closing. Let's say that your assignment is to work with the children. Did you know that when you win, when you maximize your talent, when you perform to the best of your ability, you are a champion servant? Because you're really not doing that for your benefit. Although there's certainly a benefit involved. I mean, you get the fulfillment and satisfaction of knowing that you've made a difference. You have the fulfillment of knowing that you're going to hear, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," when you go to heaven. That Jesus is going to look at you and say, "You know what, you didn't just live a selfish life. You know, you gave yourself to others. Well done." But you're a champion servant because when you serve those children well, that child is going to end up with a better life because of the principles and the values that you instilled in that child. That child is going to be a more secure, more healthy individual because of the unconditional love that you showed to that child. That child perhaps may avoid, you know, all kinds of problems in his or her life. They may avoid drug usage. They may avoid alcohol, you know, problems. They may avoid, you know, crime problems because of the values that you put in their life. You're a champion servant. When you do your job well, somebody else wins. Their parents are better off because that child may learn not to talk back to mom and dad. Their teachers in school are going to be better off because of the values. That's what being a champion servant is. When you do your job well, somebody else wins. That's what pleases God, and that's what makes dream teams come into being. So we're going to take a quick break here.